From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Danielle Gaines. I'm Kojo Namdi. I'm sure with us off today, our guest analyst is Danielle Gaines. She's a reporter for Maryland Matters. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with D.C. Council member Charles Allen, who represents Ward 6 on the D.C. Council. Joining us in studio now is Lily Chi. She is delegate-elect representing Montgomery County in the Maryland House of Delegates. Delegate-elect Chi, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kojo, for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Danielle Gaines, let's start with the lawsuit that's been around for some 12 years that supporters of HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, have filed against the state of Maryland. It would now appear that a panel of judges in the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has called for mediation, and that mediation, it says, has to be completed by April 30th. Otherwise, you're going to spend another series of decades resolving this issue. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is a case that started, as you said, many years ago in 2005. It started with Morgan State University challenging a decision to create an MBA program at Towson University. At the crux of the lawsuit is the fact that HBCUs in the state have been undermined when similar curriculum is introduced at white public institutions, and that the population at HBCUs has suffered
as a result.
Yeah, exactly. So the number of other ethnicities at HBCUs has declined. And so they want money to put their course offerings on parity with other public institutions in the state. The court set a deadline of April 30th. They want monthly updates. This would coincide the mediation talks with the General Assembly session. So you might see lawmakers trying to get into the fray and say what they'd like to see out of a settlement opportunity.
Because the Maryland Legislative Black Caucus has this is one of their priorities for years.
It's a top priority. Yeah, it bubbles in all the legislation that comes before the General Assembly each year.
And Governor Larry Hogan, as a member of the Board of Public Works, has voted against the Potomac Pipeline with the two other members of that board. It was unanimous. Talk about that.
So this is a small stretch of pipeline, 3.5 miles, that would run in the western part of the state. And what the Board of Public Works was considering was the actual easement for the land that would allow the work to begin on this pipeline. Other approvals have already been granted for this pipeline through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. So this was kind of a procedural vote. It could be challenged. That hasn't been made clear yet. Those advocates in Annapolis who have been opposed to fracking for many years, you know, certainly cheered this as a way to at least stall work on this effort. There are hundreds of miles of pipelines running under Maryland. So this is a relatively small part of the debate.
It's my understanding the governor got a letter signed by some 60 members of the General Assembly. He apparently agreed with them on this. And I guess this helps to solidify his reputation for being able to work across party lines, doesn't it?
Of course, yeah. So in 2017, Governor Hogan, at near the end of that legislative session when a fracking ban was kind of in a state of turmoil, there were amendments being considered in the Senate that would have changed that bill so it didn't match the House bill anymore. The governor came out and said that he actually would support a full-out fracking ban. So he's been kind of building on that reputation since 2017.
Our guest is Lily Chi. She's delegate-elect representing Montgomery County in the Maryland House of Delegates. First, congratulations on your win.
Thank you so much, Kojo.
This was your first time running for state office, but you've been involved with Montgomery County politics for a while. Why did you decide to run for the House of Delegates?
Well, thank you very much, Kojo, for asking that question. I decided to run for a couple of important reasons to me. First of all, I have lived and worked in this region for 20 years, and I worked for both Washington, D.C. and Montgomery County. I have witnessed the dramatic demographic and economic changes of our time. I understand why people like me came here and why this place is attractive to so many people. I want to make sure that we continue to be a magnet for talent and opportunities and investments. And I think my experience and my community involvement would bring important perspectives to make me an effective legislator. And I also believe that, you know, today's Montgomery County, in today's Montgomery County, which is one-third foreign-born in its population makeup, it's time for us to move beyond the celebration of diversity to really look at a community integration, and I believe running for office is an ultimate form of community integration.
When you're sworn in next week, you'll have the distinction of being the first Chinese-born person in Maryland's legislature. In your victory speech, you said that your campaign greatly accelerated the Chinese-American community's social and political integration and maturity. Can you explain how that works?
Sure. Well, I'm impressed that you actually listened to my victory speech. I never considered that a victory speech, probably off-the-cuff remarks. But yes, I am proud not only that as a first-timer I was able to win, but also how we ran and won this campaign. I had a choice when I entered the race. I probably could have won without engaging the immigrant Chinese community to the extent that I did. But I would not have been proud of the race I ran if I did not bring along my community. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to practice what I have been preaching. I've been writing and speaking about these community civic and political engagement issues for years. And I've been trying to bring others along to get more actively involved in political realm. And when I started this campaign, I felt that it was important. Now, because I'm a Chinese immigrant, the most excited base for me was also the least experienced base. There was no infrastructure in my direct community to know what to do, even for the people who wanted to help me. So I literally had to run two concurrent campaigns to reach out to the super Dems, which were, would be those reliable primary Democratic voters. To distinguish myself as a credible candidate. At the same time, I had to launch a separate campaign to reach out to the Chinese American voters to bring them along and to unleash their energy. I think there was a pent-up demand to be more encouraged, to be more engaged, and my campaign simply provided a vehicle for that.
So if you are blazing a trail yourself as a candidate, who do you look up to? Who are you inspired by politically?
Well, I think I am inspired by a lot of people who are trailblazers in their own ways. I'm inspired by a lot of women lawmakers. I'm inspired by our county executive who just retired, Ike Leggett, when he became the first minority to be elected to the county executive at that time. Montgomery County was still majority white. I was so inspired that I actually wrote an op-ed piece in the Gazette at that time. And I also answered to his call to serve in his administration. He has been a great leader for our community. He has been a great supporter of my run for office. I'm also inspired by other Asian American legislators. Each one of them had to, you know, blaze their own trail in their own ways.
Ike Leggett was our guest on this show last week. He doesn't have a job. He says he's not looking for a job. The man has way too much time on his hands. As you talked about, you reached out to many members of the Asian American immigrant community. You wrote columns in local Chinese language papers. You made targeted calls to people with Chinese names on the voter rolls. What are some of the concerns you heard expressed from some of the people you talked to?
Well, the Chinese immigrant voters, and by the way, the Asian Americans in the National Capital Region are mostly immigrants. So the issues they care about tend to be more bread and butter issues about education, about economy, because that was mostly why people like us came here for opportunities. As opposed to the reliable Democratic voters in the primary who tend to move beyond that and look at some value issues. So I have heard a lot about transportation concerns, about economic security concerns, about educational opportunities, how to make sure Maryland and Montgomery County stay competitive to continue to expand opportunities. Some of the equity issues as well, depending on who you talk to. But the Chinese community especially, as well as the larger Asian American community in Montgomery County, by and large, is highly educated. They tend to get very analytical about things, and they also tend to get skeptical about certain policies that might sound too good to be true in their minds, because they know why they came here. So we have heard my my team and I have heard a broad range of issues, but most of them, as I said, are, you know, those basic community concerns related to education, economy, and access to opportunities and competitiveness.
Danielle?
Well, back to just your election victory. So you won election on the same night that many other Emerge Maryland alumni won elections. So I was wondering, Emerge has trained 103 women in the state, Democratic women, since 2012. 11 women won election to the General Assembly on the same night as you. 10 of them were first-time candidates. What do you think makes that program successful? You're a graduate.
Yes, thank you for asking this question. I'm very grateful for Emerge Maryland's training that really not only prepared us, but pushed us to jumping and run. I think what was effective was this peer support that gave us this pressure to actually jumping to run. That was important because even after the tactical training, you still have the courage, still have to have the courage to run. So that encouragement was really important. And also just to be able to reach out to other friends, ladies who say, this is what I have been through. You don't have to be afraid of this. You know, that was important. And also just the technicality of how to run a campaign and how to use social media, you know, even what to wear, you know, the appearances, how to deliver your sound bites and all that, get to the point. All of that training was very helpful.
You have been placed on the Economic Matters Committee.
Correct.
In the House. Where do you think Maryland is getting economic development right, and where do you think it could improve?
Wow, that's a weighty question, but it's a great question.
For somebody who hasn't started the job yet.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Well, I do have some strong opinions when it comes to economic matters. I think what Maryland gets right is we have been a great magnet in our educational system, in our ability to attract the talent. We are actually one of the top states in the country in terms of our innovation assets and our ability to leverage global talent. In recent years, especially, we have been improving our game in economic competitiveness. And especially in Montgomery County, we have invested a lot in infrastructure improvements, in placemaking, in smart growth, et cetera. We have had great success on many fronts. Where we could improve is to continue to work on the perception that we're not as business friendly as we need to be, that we tend to be a nanny state that overregulate, that we continue to send conflicting messages sometimes about how welcoming we are to businesses. And I think we have some work to do. I think it's important for legislators at the state level to be aligned at the county level, you know, where I used to work, to make sure we are very serious about growing our economy by looking outward and forward and not just looking at how we can reslice the pies in many different ways.
Well,
because that in and of itself is not enough.
Well, you used to work for Ike Leggett
Yes.
as Montgomery County Executive, and one of the challenges that the current county executive, Mark Eldridge, has faced is accusations that he is not as business-friendly as he should be. He has fought against those challenges, but what do you think about Mark Eldridge and business development in Montgomery County?
Well, I think Mark has some challenges, and I applaud him for making it very clear in his inaugural speech that he's going to benchmark. One is that he is going to reform the county government to make sure it's much more collaborative and responsive to community needs, and that's sorely needed. I also believe that. And I encouraged him and his team to look at a deeper cultural change so that we adopt a healthy mindset in looking at businesses and job creators. I also think, you know, Mark was right in making it clear that he wants to benchmark Montgomery County's business regulation against the other in the capital region, especially. And I think it's about time to do that. Not every county executive can finish everything they started. I think County Executive Leggett made a tremendous strides, especially in placemaking, infrastructure improvements, and in pushing for innovation, commercialization, et cetera, and workforce development. But County Executive Eldridge needs to continue that. He's no longer the council member. If you are one of nine, it's a different game than if you are the top elected official.
Danielle?
One of the major issues that your committee has faced in the past couple of years in Annapolis is the issue of alcohol regulation in the state. The Economic Matters Committee has butted heads with Comptroller Peter Francho, who would like to see things freed up and a lot more support for, you know, the craft breweries, mm-hmm. for instance, and getting rid of the state control of liquor in Montgomery County. What are your thoughts on alcohol regulation and how it should change?
Well, I think for especially the capital region jurisdictions like Montgomery County and Prince George's County, it is beyond time that we act more like cities. That includes a vibrant nighttime economy, that includes connectivity, that includes just an overall vitality. And a craft brewery not only is great in placemaking, but it also is a manufacturing kind of industry. It is not a retail business. We branded it, it's categorized actually as a manufacturing business. They create the kind of sense of a place for communities. And that's why Montgomery County, especially under leadership of former council president Hans Riemer, has been focusing on encouraging the growth of that industry, which I think is great emerging industry. In fact, just the past year, County Council passed legislation to expand our MOVE program, which initially was only for office market, to also include craft brewery, so that the production part would qualify, so that we can attract more brewery to downtown places. And I personally would encourage the growth of that, but we have to look at the ramifications of where we have that, that would make sense, and what kind of impact, economic impact, and placemaking value it actually offers. I know there is a lot of discussion about privatization, and I think some reform is needed. I will keep an open mind in working with other legislators to figure out the best way to move forward.
Another issue that will be in front of the General Assembly is a tobacco sales ban for people under the age of 21, a move that the District of Columbia already made. Do you think this makes sense?
I think it does.
Yeah. Well, that was precise. You've pointed out that although 1 in 3 Montgomery County public school students receive free and reduced price lunches,
right.
quoting here, we continue to operate under the assumption that our demographics are the same as generations ago. Mm-hmm. How do you think the changing demographics of Montgomery County should affect how the county and the state approach education?
Well, education is our top brand in attracting people and businesses. So education is always the top priority for any legislators. I think on an education front, we need to look at the, both the not just the middle part, but also the beginning and the end. What I mean by that is the early childhood education. We need to continue to push for making early childhood education more affordable and accessible to families. And also, we need to look at how to be more career ready, not just college ready, especially for high performing counties like Montgomery County. We have culturally been programmed to push our kids to go to college. But in this new economy, in this gig economy, there are so many opportunities, middle wage, middle skill jobs that are not being filled. So I hope we can adopt a new way of thinking and approach to look at education so that we can really connect our talent pipeline with the demands of the market and the growing industries.
When you talk about the changing demographics of Montgomery County, there are a group of high school students that are actually advocating for a countywide redistricting to create student bodies that are more diverse. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that push?
I support diversifying student body, but it depends on how we do that. I know there have been some concerns from some parents about the different tactics that the MCPS system has been using in busing students around. And I think part of it is engaging the community to make sure the parents are on board and understand what real value they offer in the educational process. I believe in the value of a diversified student body, whether it's in MCPS, whether it's in K-12 stage or in higher education.
You are the parent of a Montgomery County Public School graduate. Mm-hmm. The future of school funding in Maryland is an open question as the Kerwin Commission's recommendations have been delayed mm-hmm. once again. Mm-hmm. What do you think the county needs in terms of funding and support from the state in the lead up to discussions over school funding in this coming legislative session?
Yeah, I know the Kerwin Commission spent 2 years and it did a tremendous amount of work in coming up with the two kinds of mandate. One is to come up with a funding formula, and the other is to come up with a set of strategies to make sure that Maryland has a world-class, not a mediocre, educational system that is equitable for all communities. Now the challenge for the state legislature is to figure out how to fund some of these great recommendations and how to implement them, and also how to figure out how much the counties need to pay versus how much the state need to pay. And I think, you know, Montgomery County has been great in funding education overall. Of course, it's never going to be enough because of the community needs and the population makeup. But Montgomery County has been very dedicated in making sure that we have world-class education for all students. I think going forward as a state legislator, my job, along with everybody else's job from Montgomery County delegation, is to make sure that our colleagues from other parts of Maryland understand this dynamic that you mentioned earlier, which is 1 in 3 child in our wealthiest county system is on free and reduced meals program. And on top of that, you know, we have the fastest growing ESOL population in our MCPS, and we want to make sure we have a fair share of educational resources and funding.
Our guest is Lily Chi. She's a delegate-elect representing Montgomery County in the Maryland House of Delegates. Our guest analyst today is Danielle Gaines. She's a reporter for Maryland Matters. Danielle.
Hello. Oh, I get to ask a question?
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on transportation. There's this, you know, big project that Governor Hogan is proposing that would radically change I-270 and the Beltway and the way that they operate. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the best solution for that?
Well, I adopt all of the above kind of solutions. I am a fan of public transit. I grew up in Shanghai. I think public transit is the way to go to provide not just transportation equity, but social equity as well for a lot of people who rely on public transportation. But public transit has its limit in where the density can occur to justify funding. For the district that I represent, District 15, we probably have people who have to commute the longest distance to work because it's mostly a fairly suburban and quite rural district. So we need to look at improving I-270. It should not be off the table. And I-270 was built two generations ago. Since then, the population has literally doubled in Montgomery County alone. But it doesn't have to be the Hove Lane as the only option. We can look at the different ways of improving I-270, including interchanges at different chokeholds, including, for example, reversible lanes that the county council thought was a great idea and have been pushing for. The state needs to come up with enabling legislation, and MDOT needs to support that in order for that to happen.
Do you think that tolls are the answer?
Well, I don't want to say tolls should not be considered because we already have infrastructure built like ICC where people pay to move along. And if you need it, it's there for you. You know, it's never crowded and it's by design. So I think tolls could be an option, but I haven't looked at it in detail at the governor's proposal. And I'm looking forward to the MDOT study to understand the economic impact and what it actually could mean when you take away when you add two toll lanes.
Put on your headphones, please, because we're about to speak with Ian in Prince William County, Virginia. Ian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a child welfare advocate in Virginia who works with the General Assembly here to support child welfare and child protection legislation. And I wondered if the delegate could speak to your assessment of child protection needs in your state. And are you aware of bills being filed to strengthen the system of response in child abuse investigations? And what do you see as your state's strengths and your state's needs?
Okay. Thank you for the call. I have to say that I have not looked at that set of issues at this point, but I'm more than happy to take your question and study that. I am a new legislator. There's so much more to learn on many fronts, and I appreciate your call.
Ian, thank you very much for your call. On to Nan in Silver Spring, Maryland. Nan, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for taking my call. I want to urge our new legislator, whom I congratulate on her election, to try to move the study of the transportation options concerning the Beltway and 270 more towards a 21st century solution involving greater public transport rather than widening, which has been proven over, you know, after 3 years, it'll fill up again. And it's so not a 21st century solution. It's not green, it's not smart, and it will disrupt a lot of lives in this county. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. I agree. I think public transit should be a first priority. And I also mentioned that the reversible lanes should be something that we should look at.
We got an email from Joanna who says, in local work on behalf of immigrants in Montgomery County who are not documented or who are at risk of losing their lawful status, I have been saddened by the strong feelings of intolerance towards this community that I have seen from the Chinese immigrant community. Can you address this issue and what, if anything, you could do in your leadership position to help the Chinese immigrant, to help your Chinese immigrant constituents work as allies with these other immigrant groups so that both communities can benefit from each other's strengths and contributions?
Thank you for the question. I know this was a controversial issue that was reported by several media. I have to say that we need to differentiate the larger community sentiment toward immigration with a group of people who spoke out. Just because a group of people organize themselves to speak out, that does not mean everybody in the Chinese community thinks the same. And also, just because one group spoke out against the one particular bill does not mean our community in general is anti-immigration or is not welcoming to our communities. I, for one, using my campaign's experience, have been educating our community about the importance that as a very small subset of minorities in this country, we have to engage with other communities, we have to collaborate, we have to support each other. And that was part of the reason many people are Democrats and they voted in the Democratic primary, because we understand this is not in China. This is United States. We have to work with many other communities in order to succeed together.
We're almost out of time, but House Majority Leader Kathleen Dume, another Montgomery County Democrat, has said that she urges new lawmakers to introduce a bill in their first session. Have you thought about whether you're going to do that and do you intend to do that?
I have considered several possibilities. So are you saying that Delegate Dume urges lawmakers?
New lawmakers to introduce a bill in their first session.
Yes.
I think
yeah.
at orientation,
said,
she said, you know, you learn by doing.
Right. I have considered several ideas, one of which is, for example, an SBIR matching grant. I feel strongly that the Maryland and Montgomery County's flagship industry, the biotech, biohealth industry, which is a 21st century industry, needs to be nurtured so that we can be among the top three jurisdictions as our goal. And Montgomery County already had legislation, had supplemental funding to create a matching fund for those companies, early stage biomedical companies that have qualified through NIH SBIR grant, which is Small Business Innovation Research Grant. I think it's time for us to compete with other states by creating a state level matching fund so that we can attract those executive teams, early stage companies to Montgomery County and Maryland.
Lily Chi is the delegate-elect representing Montgomery County in the Maryland House of Delegates. Once again, congratulations and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Kojo.
Up next is Charles Allen. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 6. Our guest analyst today is Danielle Gaines. She is a reporter for Maryland Matters. And Danielle, one of the consequences of the partial shutdown of the federal government that people may not have expected is that people have not been able to get marriage licenses in D.C., nor have they been able to get married at D.C. Superior Court. We recently did a pop-up at D.C. Superior Court and witnessed a wedding taking place there. Mm-hmm. We couldn't be doing it during the shutdown, but D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser is apparently going to put forth emergency legislation that established the authority to issue marriage licenses during this shutdown. People, I guess, will run over to Maryland to get married.
I guess so. I was a courthouse reporter in Maryland for many years, and the highlight always for a dreary day was seeing a wedding take place in the courthouse. That's legislation that I think is going to become before the D.C. City Council next week, and it would actually allow her office to kind of issue those licenses so that people can get married. There is this rule that I think is not really enforced in D.C. law that says if you get married without a license or you don't turn in a license within a certain period of time, you can receive a small fine, $50 or something, I think.
D.C. Councilmember representing Ward 6, Charles Allen, joins us in studio. Councilmember Allen, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And I have come straight from the Hill where our congresswoman was reintroducing legislation with a record number of co-sponsors for statehood. And we talked exactly about this issue as well, that the federal government shutting down, besides the fact they should just be able to figure out how to keep their lights on, shouldn't impact district lives. And we'll figure this out with the courts. But I would argue, actually, the fact that our local courts are being essentially shut down because of federal government's just one more example of the disenfranchisement that we face. And that is yet one more reason why statehood should be our goal so that we have that self-determination that we all deserve.
Speaking of that disenfranchisement, the press conference that you are arriving here from was addressing the issue of voting rights and statehood for the district. Give us an update. What's going on?
Well, I'm really grateful for the leadership from Congresswoman Norton. She's got a record number of co-sponsors, which I think is years worth of hard work to get more and more of the national lawmakers, in particular the Democrats, to put their names on this bill. And it's building itself more and more into just the platform of democracy. I mean,
Is it a bill for statehood?
It is a bill for statehood, yes.
Okay.
Congressman Cummings has promised that he's going to hold a hearing.
Elijah Cummings of
Maryland. Exactly. That he's going to hold a hearing and committed to a markup. Speaker Pelosi put out a press release today as well, signaling her support. So I'm very optimistic for what we can do in the House. I think that we still, of course, have a lot of work to do in the Senate because we've got to get to 60 votes on that. And then there's this other small impediment at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But, there's an election in 2 years, so we'll see what happens.
The federal government is, of course, partially shut down. D.C. is being hit particularly hard. Our Department of Public Works is picking up trash at national parks throughout the district. How does the district decide to do something like that? And will the taxpayers or will D.C. get paid back by the federal government for this?
We will eventually. If you remember a couple of years ago when the federal government couldn't get their act together, the district government would shut down. And I think it was Vince Gray, when he was mayor, just declared everybody was essential. And we just kind of dared them and said, we're not going to do this. And then, frankly, it was with Congresswoman Norton's efforts. They actually wrote it into the appropriations budget that made sure that D.C. government, regardless of what happens with folks up on the Hill, we keep running. And, we're picking up the trash right now. We're going to pitch in and do that because this is our city. I mean, we're going to take care of it. We just wish the federal government could figure this out. They need to open up. I've got thousands of constituents who are furloughed and out of work right now. They're working without a paycheck. It's just irresponsible what they're doing and just this gamesmanship over a needless wall. Let's get government working. Let's work on immigration reform and have the adults in the room show up.
As a small thank you for picking up the trash, they should give us statehood. But Danielle, it's your turn.
I know Maryland allows unemployment claims for federal government workers who aren't being paid, and hundreds of people have applied already. Does D.C. do the same?
I don't know if we hit that point yet because I think the first paycheck miss will be
in a couple of days.
Yeah. In a couple of days next week. And so we'll have to figure that out from then. My hope is they'll certainly have it over with by that point. If we need to, at the end of the day, again, we want to take care of our residents. And so whether that means pitching in to pick up the trash at the parks or whether making sure that we're looking after unemployment, making sure folks have the benefits they need, we'll take a look at that. I don't know off the top of my head exactly how that unemployment would work, but we'll certainly make sure that our folks are taken care of.
For the record, Maryland makes them pay it back if they get paid.
Our guest is Charles Allen. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 6. He is also the chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee on the council. Charles Allen, last week was a violent one in the district, and the homicide rate is up around 40% from what it was in 2017. What do you think is going on? Why did we see this kind of increase in homicides in the past year?
Yeah, It's incredibly tragic, and I would say every single life that is lost is equally tragic. So, you know, we've got just heart-wrenching stories like Makai Wilson and others who gunned down and their lives have ended. And it's a tragedy for them, obviously, but for their families, but really for their entire communities that circle out from them and from those lives. It's unacceptable, and certainly as the legislative branch, my job is to make sure we're having the oversight and funding and making sure that we're pushing where we need to hold our agencies accountable for developing the strategies. But I'd argue that we also have to do a much better job as a city of trying to understand what it means for the violence to take place. And what I mean by that is that violent crime didn't just come out of nowhere. You'll hear buzzwords like, you know, we need to think about this from a public health approach. But I think we really have to drill down in a deeper way. Because if many of the homicides, as we're hearing, are really from petty disputes between two people that turn violent, there's no amount of just flooding police into a neighborhood that is going to solve if two individuals in their living room are going to be having a fight or an argument that then one decides to end that with a gun. We've got to make sure that we are getting at root causes of violence, and that means taking a public health approach to look at the transmission of that violence. I mentioned Makai Wilson. Think about the experience that every other person on that playground experienced that day as bullets were flying through the air, a young girl shot, killed, dead. The violence that each one of those people now take from that incident has its own impacts that will be deeply lasting within their own lives and their community. And it is those efforts, I think, where we've got to do a stronger job. I think we need to double down on the type of violence interruption work that we're doing. We're putting a couple of million dollars into the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement and some cure violence models with the Attorney General. I'm looking to see how do we dramatically increase the funding and supports that go into that. We say all the time things like, you know, police can't do this alone. Well, the way we've been operating is essentially only with police. We've got to get ahead of this by trying to stop the violence before it takes place, before that trigger gets pulled, before that argument even gets to where it is that someone decides to settle it with a gun or a knife. And that's where I think we have so much more work to do. And that's part of what, as the chair of the committee on this, I'm going to be looking for the mayor's budget to come down with substantially more resources and intention around that violence interruption work. And if it's not there, then I'm going to be looking to find places to find more money and more resources to put into these efforts.
Seems that much of the gun violence is concentrated in certain parts of the city, mostly east of the river, with a lot of young people there losing their lives. So when you talk about the mayor targeting violence interruption, are you also saying that you got to look at specific parts of the city and fund those efforts adequately?
Well, you've got to have the type of effort where someone has credibility on the street. So what I mean by that is you've got to make sure that when we're investing these programs, we've got, for example, with the cure violence model that we're trying to work on with the Attorney General's office, it's two relatively small pilot programs, one neighborhood in Ward 5, one neighborhood in Ward 8. It is barely scratching the surface. They're doing good work, no doubt, but they hire individuals from and within a community who have credibility on the street, who are able to relate to individuals, both in their own life experience as well as their relationships with those individuals, and they can make a quantifiable difference in being able to anticipate violence, know when it's coming. It's too late if we're having to look to say, did that shooting that already took place, is that going to contribute with a retaliatory shooting of some type? We should be in front of it and have the type of system that gets built to get in front of it in the first place and know when an argument or a conflict is building before that crescendo and before that trigger gets pulled. That's the type of effective community violence prevention work that we've got to be moving toward.
How much money do you think should be put towards those kinds of efforts? What do you think is a realistic number?
Well, right now, if you add all of it up, we put about $5 million a year into this, and that's relatively small. If you think about our police department, it's $500 million. Now, by no means am I saying we don't need to have strong, effective policing. We certainly do. But we need to invest at the same time. And I would love to see us figure out how can we double that? How can we get from 5 to 10? That would double the impact, I think, in terms of the ability for communities to be significantly and dramatically improved. But I'd also add one other component of this. If we don't address the mental health and behavioral health aspects of this, again, violent crime didn't come out of nowhere. There are plenty of examples where there are individuals who have touched our criminal justice system or our mental health and behavioral health system, and we have not intervened in a way that stopped that. I'll use another example. Think of the shooting that took place on the grocery store on H Street. There's a guy named Michael Watley who came in with an attempted robbery and shot one of the workers there. An inch or two to the left, we would not be talking about a shooting, we'd be talking about a homicide. When we look back through his story, you see someone who has had multiple interactions with the criminal justice system, with the mental health and behavioral health system. He is going to have to and should have the consequences for his actions on that day. But when we do the deep dive, we will also find that there is no system, that there were multiple touch points and we did not intervene in a way that could have stopped that from ever happening. He put hundreds of lives at risk, or at least significantly traumatized, at that grocery store. When the police were coming to arrest him, he was in a closet with a gun. I think he was on Facebook Live or something like that. All those officers' lives were at risk as they were now trying to apprehend this individual. The number of lives impacted by his decision that day, he's going to have to face consequences for that decision. But we should also be able to hold the mirror up and look and say, why have we failed to build the type of system that recognizes the mental health and behavioral health aspects of this that get to the root causes of violence? That's
indeed,
where we have
a lot of room for improvement. Indeed, when we went to D.C. Superior Court, we heard from people in the media, we heard from judges, we heard from people who also work in courtrooms there that way too many of the cases that are coming before them should have been dealt with first in our mental health care system before they got to the level of the court.
I think you're assuming there's a system that exists. I think that we don't have much of a system. That to me is where, you know, I come at this job as chair of the committee with a public health background. So I'm not an attorney. I'm not somebody who's spent a career in law enforcement. I'm somebody who comes at it with a public health degree. So part of what I want to do is I think I have an ability to bring a vision that's a little bit different of how do we work on safe and just neighborhoods, but how do we start building the bridges between our mental health and behavioral health? I've had some great conversations with Vince Gray, who chairs the health committee, about this. How do we build this in a way that we can actually have it work and start delivering on what it is that we're all talking about? You'll hear the buzzwords and the catchphrases over and over again, but it's time for us to really get to work on how we build a system that will actually work and keep our neighborhoods and all of our residents safe.
The ACLU of D.C. tweets in, 100% agree with Councilmember Allen that we need to drill down and work to address root causes of violence and how we can prevent violence from happening in the first place, to which Black Lives Matter D.C. responded, absolutely. You mentioned Vince Gray and the Committee on Health. Before the end of the year, there were heated debates over the plans for a new hospital. What is the current status of those plans?
Well, the council passed legislation at the end of our session in December. So I think, I'm not sure if I can use as many different health analogies as possible. It's still on life support. It's moving forward. I think that we've got a operator that is still very interested in doing this. We've allocated and budgeted the dollars to help build a new hospital. I think it's critically important that we improve our health system on the eastern half of the city. You know, Ward 6 represents, I'm right up to the edge of the river. And when I talk to neighbors, for example, in Southeast and Southwest, oftentimes, if we had the type of quality healthcare that I think all residents deserve on the other side of the river, that's actually closer for many Ward 6 residents than it is to drive across town to GW or somewhere. So I think, not only because I believe it's the right thing for our city, but I think I have an interest as the Ward 6 council member. I want to see something that's going to deliver better quality care. And you just think about the inequity that we talk about in our city, whether you want to focus on education, whether you want to talk about, like we were just talking about, neighborhood violence, or in health. We have a duty to do a much better job around our health equity. You know, another intersection of where we've tried to take our committee is maternal health, maternal mortality. And it's an area where, because I have oversight of the chief medical examiner, we're trying to create, in which I passed legislation to create a maternal mortality review committee for the first time ever, for us to take a deeper look, use data, use evidence to help inform us around the policy decisions we make, the budget decisions we make, to help save lives. We have a disproportionate impact between Black women and white women around what the health outcomes are in maternal health. And it's unacceptable. And I think that we've got a real opportunity in front of us to make great strides in that.
I think Maryland's passed a maternal mortality review committee. Have you dipped into their work? Do you know what they found? I think they have a report due this year.
The idea behind it is that there will be kind of the annual reports where they do an annual review of each maternal death, essentially. And it lays out recommendations. We heard from experts from Maryland. We have folks who had been involved with New York's effort, where they also see a huge disparity in New York City in particular, and really got valuable insight about how to craft a maternal mortality review committee that is going to take a deep look at and intentionally look at that inequity, intentionally look at that disparity. Because if we don't look at it intentionally, then it's just going to kind of float behind the surface. We've got to be right up front with it. And that's how I think it'll then better inform the decisions that we make on the council and then working with the mayor to try to reverse those and make sure that we're helping. Frankly, I don't want a single mom to die. I mean, how do we make sure that there is no maternal death?
Ward 6 includes the site of the old football stadium. You have challenged the plan to bring Washington's football team back to the district, saying, quoting here, "Helping a billionaire build a new NFL stadium, I just think is a bad idea." What would you like to see happen at that old RFK site?
Well, I think the experience you'll see from around the country is that building an NFL stadium is a boondoggle and is a complete waste of taxpayer dollars, but it's also a really bad use of land. I mean, we have a great opportunity right next to the Anacostia River where we could extend our city. We talk about solving affordable housing. Well, that means we need to build more housing. And so one of the things that we have in front of us is an opportunity to build more housing, continue the neighborhoods from Oklahoma Avenue and 19th Street all the way down to the river's edge. And Kingman Park and Hill East, I think, have an opportunity to extend single-family housing, higher density housing. You've got transit right there. We could build retail. I'd argue you probably get more economic development and bang for your buck with a new grocery store than you would an NFL stadium. These things don't create economic opportunity. They get 8 games a year played, maybe a handful of concerts, and they're over $1 billion to build. And not to mention all the parking lots they come with. It's just a really bad use of space. It's a bad use of tax dollars. And we could do so much more with a better vision around housing, new jobs being created with retail, new parks and green spaces, and then bring the river back into our community, into our city.
8 games a year because the team rarely makes the playoffs. But Polly has an idea for you. Polly emailed, "We in Ward 6 have been waiting for a park. What is happening in this area?"
Well, I am very glad about one thing that's happening at RFK, and that is that I've spent about 6 years now working toward this. We are ripping up the asphalt parking lots on the northern side of this. So this is basically from Binning Road south. And we are replacing that now with new fields and green space. It is going to be athletic fields, multi-sport so that it can be adaptable. There's a farmer's market there, so we're actually going to be making it a bit more permanent with kind of a market shed, essentially, to kind of give them a more sense of permanency. For the first time, there will be restrooms that exist, which will be something I know every parent would like to see out there. And it really creates a great opportunity to re-envision the space, create more green space and park space. Whether it's a youth league or an adult league, we are desperate for more green space and park space in our city, and this is a great opportunity for that.
There you go, Polly. The council passed a red flag gun bill requiring police to seize weapons from people deemed a danger to themselves or to others. The bill has faced some pushback, including from the Public Defender Service, which said it would allow police to seize guns without giving proper notice or without having a court hearing. How do you respond to that criticism? And do you think this is the right approach to tackling, or one right approach to tackling gun violence in the district?
Well, I'm very proud of the law, and I think it is one of. It's certainly not going to be the only thing, but it is one item that I think is going to have an impact. And so what it does is it allows an individual, in particular perhaps a family member, someone who's close to you, and they know that you have a firearm and you have expressed an interest in either doing self-harm or harm to others. And you can always, today, you could call the police and give a tip and they could come in and try to remove that firearm. But this gives another way where people can come through the courts and be able to have a very quick action that is taken and then have a civil order, essentially, that allows the police to come in and remove that firearm before you do harm to yourself or to others. I think it's going to be one more tool in the toolbox of helping get getting a gun out of the hands of someone who's expressed harm, again, an interest to do harm, either for themselves or for others. But to also do so in a way that gives loved ones, family members, those that are close to them, an opportunity to take an action. What we oftentimes see is that an individual, especially a family member, may not want to actually make that tip, make that phone call to say someone's got an illegal firearm because they know there are criminal consequences that are coming with that illegal firearm. And one of the novel things that this legislation does is it grants in a very limited scope and for a very, very narrow opportunity for this protection order, immunity, so that the family member knows, I need to get that gun out of son, daughter, husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend's hands, but I don't want them to have to go to jail for it, and that may be the reason why they don't call in the first place.
Well, so apparently both Mayor Bowser and the police chief and the U.S. attorney oppose that immunity provision. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, this will be one of those areas where we have a bit of disagreement. I think that you'll also hear, though, from, for example, many of the domestic violence survivors organizations that have talked in strong support of this because they understand the reality that we are going to have instances where someone is afraid to make the phone call, is afraid to give that tip, is afraid to take that action that is going to save the life of that individual or others. But if they know that that person's not going to face the criminal consequence for just the possession, they'll make the phone call. Now, please remember that immunity does not exist if you commit a crime with that gun, if you have made direct threats. There's plenty of ways in which that immunity does not carry it, but for the possession, it will grant that limited, narrow immunity, and I think it will have an impact, and I think it will save lives.
If you have a 10-second question, we only have about less than a minute left.
That bill was passed, I think, at the same time as a ban on bump stocks. Yes. Have there been community meetings? Have you heard from the community other ways that they think gun violence could be curbed?
We had about 25 seconds.
Well, the other piece of this legislation also actually extended penalties for extended clips. So for we went from 1 year to 3 years for an individual who has an extended clip because we were seeing that there was increased lethality by more bullets flying through the air. So the bill takes a comprehensive approach. But I'll bring it back to where we started, which was violence prevention. That's where I hear more voices in the community saying, we want effective policing. We want to have partners with our policing. But we also want to have us focus on preventing and interrupting violence.
Charles Allen is a member of the D.C. Council. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery. A quick note about our programming. I'm happy to announce that transcripts of the Kojo Namdi Show will now be available on our website. Go to kojoshow.org and you'll find them under the transcript link on each show's page. They'll be posted by 8 p.m. daily. Thanks to our audience for your input on making our show more accessible. Coming up Monday, we'll look at obscure government agencies that are affected by the federal shutdown and explore the role of grade inflation at local school. That all starts Monday at noon. Danielle Gaines, thank you. Charles Allen, thank you. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, and Lauren Marco. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schroepsdorf. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, go to kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.